We are Brightside.
Or something like that.
Back porch.
Back
yeah.
porch.
I was in a swing right near my my bonsai planting table.
Yeah.
Where I work on my bonsai trees. So that's a good spot, good sun. So yeah, I thought that was great. A little too hot for that today though. It's exactly 11 million degrees here, so I'm not going outside because I would like to keep living.
Indoors with the AC and chatting away.
Yeah.
So.
Brent, how was your trip home, man?
Oh, the trip home was great. I had a nonstop flight. I got off and I got on the Seattle Transit and I transferred to the 512 bus and then I transferred to the number 7 bus and I was home.
Nice.
Very pleasant. I was seated next to a small child who was not loud. So I had plenty of shoulder room. And yet did not have any annoyance.
Very nice.
You like hit the travel lottery, Brent.
Like, what the heck, man?
The last I came home from Expona and they literally just like closed the door. They never announced our flight.
Wow.
My son and I are standing there watching and they never said like, last call, announce the flight, and the lady just goes over and she looks around, closes the door. I'm like, are you kidding me? We run to the next terminal. I'm like, did we just miss our flight? And they're like, yep. I was
wow.
like, they never announced anything. And the guy standing next to her goes, pretty sure they did. So that's your reply? Pretty sure? Pretty sure? You should be definite. And it was like, the only thing I can guess is we literally were probably the only people on the plane. So they just didn't say anything and they're just like, let's make this easy. If nobody shows up, we'll just, and we were like 10, 15 feet from the desk. And they probably just were like, if nobody shows up, we're just getting on this plane, going back. And that it was a direct flight back to Providence. And it was like, I think they just wanted the easy way out. I was, oh, my son and I were like flipping out, flipping out.
Where do you live?
Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where about?
Douglas, Massachusetts. Down, it's the border, you know where Connecticut and Rhode Island border Massachusetts. If you look on the map, there's that three.
Yeah.
There's a Douglas State Forest in our town that borders those three states. So I live right there. That's when I'm done with you guys, I'm heading to the Douglas State Forest to go mountain biking.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Yeah. Got to get out. So, how you guys been? Brent, I got you in. We didn't have to wait till December or November. We did it, buddy.
Oh, good. That's right.
We usually do it once a year. And you're like, let's, and every time we stop, like when we stop recording, we're like, let's do this again soon. It's like, so here we are. And, I hit you up when I was at Expona. And then I hear your podcast and you're boycotting Expona.
What?
Are we?
We're
not boycotting.
I know. You said it though. You were joking when you did your Expona coverage.
Oh, okay.
I've never been to Expona. I'd like to go to Expona.
Never.
Yeah.
Well, I'd sort of like to go to Expona. I mean, on some level, I'd rather go to Expona than,
I've never been. I thought it was pretty good.
I'd rather go to Expona than go spend another several days in Texas where I just got back from, where it's like, it's so, I mean, I'm from there, but God, it was just so miserably hot. Oh my God. So
the heat. Yeah. So guys, I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard your take, or if you have a take, I'm really interested in this. I don't know if you, I'm sure you guys don't know, but I am going to be getting the SVS Revolution speakers or Evolution.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I heard you talk briefly about it, but have you heard any more on it about like tests or anything? Because
I know my buddy Aaron has a pair now.
And, oh, he does have them now.
Yes, he does, but he is moving. And so I think it's going to have to wait until he is in his new place and all set up with his clip all before he really digs into that review, because I know a lot of people are eager to see his measurements.
Yeah. And that's one of the things. It's like, I'm going to say, I don't care about measurements. I just want to hear what people think about it. I heard them. Mm-hmm. I've seen them. I have my multiple reasons why I want them. And why I'm going to be doing it. I'm doing the pinnacles, five pinnacles for my five channels in my room.
Oh, nice.
In my new room. And one of the reasons, it has nothing to do with the sound. It has nothing to do with like the audio quality. It's literally like back when I started in the 80s, that's all you did. Like all the diagrams were tower speakers for your channels.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm like, when I saw those, I hadn't even heard them yet. I just, when they released them at, what was it, CES back in January, I was like, I said to my wife, I'm like, these are what I want to get. And she was like, okay, all right. That's, you know, like my end game speaker. And then hearing them, I thought they were awesome too. I was like, you know, I wasn't expecting to hear them and go, oh, that's not good. Right. So actually hearing them.
Yeah, good engineers over there, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I'm really excited. I want to hear what other people think about it. It's not going to change my mind because it's like having those five towers. That's completely ridiculous. I get it. It's, you don't need it, but it's a nod to where I started from and what I dreamed of back then. You know, when you're dreaming of that back then, you didn't know what was going to transpire, right? Like, yeah. Bookshelves would become the thing, and then, you know, 80 hertz crossovers, small versus large speakers, all of that stuff never existed, wasn't even a thought. And now I want to go back to that.
So you just made an interesting point. You talked about what you need, you know, and I know I don't want to speak for Brent here. I'm sure he's got slightly different thoughts on this than I do, but you know, he and I often talk about, well, do you need this? Do you need that? And I think in my case, a lot of times when we say, you know, you don't need that, you don't need X, it's not to say X is invalid. It's simply to fight back against this pervasive notion that you do need this or you're not doing it right. Right.
Right.
So there's a difference between, do you need this? Well, maybe not. Does it make you happy? Well, go for it. Yeah. You know, it's ultimately, that's what it's about. When I say, yeah, you don't need that, I'm not saying don't get it. I'm just saying don't let someone convince you that anything less than this is unacceptable. So.
Right, right. And yeah, Brent, what do you think? Like, I love listening to you guys because you tear the world apart, but you do it in such a great way.
Well, I think, look, there are some things that you need for reasonably good reproduction of audio, okay? I mean, cable lifters is one example we talk about. Yeah, on the show. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's like these little sort of sawhorse looking things that you put under your cables to lift them off the ground because the magnetic field from the cables interact with the
bridges.
Magnetic field something.
Yeah.
But those are absolutely essential if you want to have people walk into your living room and think like, oh Jesus, I can't be friends with this person. although, you know, I've been to a couple of people's homes where they had cable lifters and I thought like, I mean, yeah, they were nice people. They have pretty good systems.
They were nice people.
I can't say they're bad people because they have cable lifters, you know, I mean, probably they are, but you know, they might not be. So you don't have cable lifters because you're like more of a surround sound guy. So cable lifters for surround sound are really not practical unless you really care about, you know, sound.
Yeah. No, it's like my cables are either getting put through a wall, stapled to something, or organized in a way. And it's like, I do remember being super conscious of that stuff back in the like late 80s, early 90s of like, okay, I want my cables crossing, power and speaker cables crossing at the, you know, the 90s. Yeah. So they're not touching each other and all, and like, you don't know what you don't know. I've been saying that a lot lately, but you're like, you're trying everything and it's like, but yeah. What was funny is I had the crappiest system in the world, but I'm trying to do the stuff that would only be noticeable on like $1 million system. If it was noticeable at all.
That's like when my first like kind of okay amp was a Heathkit integrated amp that I found it at a Coney Island in New York. Used to have these like flea market ish sort of stalls. And they just had all sorts of stuff. And there was one guy who had, you know, old vintage audio gear. They didn't call it vintage at the time. And he had this Heathkit integrated amp, which is, I think, just like one I had that my dad had given me when I was like 13. And so I'm like, oh, cool. And the guy's like, look, it works. And he plugs it in. The tubes glow, right? So anyway, $5. And I got it. And then I had like some AR-M1 speakers, which were really cool speakers from, you know, the early 90s. And I read in Stereophile, they were talking about speaker cable. And back then I thought, well, maybe this makes a big difference. And Sam Talig had recommended, you know, one of the writers they had back then had recommended this Radio Shack solid core, like, I don't know, 14 gauge wire, like hookup wire. And how, you know, and they said, you know, hey, this stuff actually, you know, Sam Talig tried it and he says it sounds good. Which, what does that mean? I thought that meant something at the time. I thought like if a Stereophile writer, you know, said something was good, then it had to be good. So whereas, you know, now we have a rule, one of the principles of our podcast is anybody can listen to anything and say it sounds good, and that doesn't mean anything. But anyway, so I got these hookup wires from Radio Shack because it was cheap and I could afford it, and I didn't have like – I was working for Video Magazine at the time, and I didn't have like a line to like – the cable business wasn't what it was. Back then, it was like Monster and hardly anybody else, and so
right.
It was hard for me to get like free cables like most reviewers can. So I got these cables, and I actually kind of – and it said like you can wind them. Or if you want less series impedance, you can just like lay them flat, right? So I kind of thought like, or less inductance, you know, you just lay them flat side by side. And I thought like, I'm going to get like, I got like these little tiny pieces of plexiglass, right? They're like little plexiglass squares, which I cut out of a piece of plex. And, yeah. You know, and then I put them between the two wires and then I heat shrinked a piece of, you know, I put a piece of heat shrink like around it, right? So it held like the plex, so it held the wires spaced out. Yeah. And then I gently twisted them. So between each of the spacers, which were probably a foot apart, it twisted, I think I twisted it 90 degrees between each one. So it was this structure and it actually looked kind of like some of these just preposterous cables you see at audio shows where the guys just do something. It seems like a cool idea and they don't know what the hell they're doing. And back then I had some knowledge, but I was kind of like, well, there's this mysterious world of Stereophile and the Absolute Sound. And these guys are saying they hear all these things. And so they must be hearing all these things because they're old and they have beards. And so.
Hey, time out a second. Here, time out. Did you guys grow beards to up your credibility? Seriously.
No. I grew beards because I'm really ugly. So it was the Abe Lincoln excuse for me. No, I have had this beard since before I graduated high school. I've not really? Had a clean shaven face since the winter of 1989. So
Brent, you always haven't been like that.
No. I just did this for the pandemic. I was just like, really? I knew I was going to be sitting alone with my dog for the next 6 months to a year back in 2020. And I put my razor up to my face. I'm like, why am I doing this? And I quit.
Yeah. I remember first time I had you on and I'd been following you for literally decades. And like you'd have your picture in your articles and stuff. And you first came on. I was like, I'd never seen you with a beard before. And I was
So now it's, now it's like, I don't care that much about my appearance. So, but I guess it looks fine. I mean, people told me it looks fine. So it's so much easier to take care of.
And it ups your credibility. You know, there you go.
Yeah. I don't need,
wise man with a beard.
I know, but I hate that part. I hate that part.
Okay. It just makes wise me man with a beard.
I'm still searching for wisdom now. I'm always searching for wisdom.
That's the best wisdom you have. That's what I learned. When you realize you don't have it all, that's the wisest you could ever be.
Yeah, I think I don't need it so much on audio anymore, but I think on pretty much every other aspect of life, I pretty much do. So.
Oh, no. So I don't even know where we were before I interrupted you with the beard comment. I was talking about stereophile. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And how I thought these guys really were like these masters. And then I actually ended up. You want to hear a story?
I thought we were in one. Never okay.
I do.
Never before told. So I got Stereophile. It was a weird story. I ended up in the hospital for a week, and a friend of mine, Ken Corman, who worked with me at Video Magazine, brought me, just kind of as a joke, brought me a copy of The Absolute Sound and a copy of Stereophile, back when they were digest size, right? Like little tiny. And he I had something to read while I was in the hospital. And that kind of got me hooked. And Absolute Sound, I was kind of like, no, this is kind of stupid, but and also really full of itself. But Stereophile made some sense to me, and it was more entertaining. And so Robert Harley wrote for him at the time. Now he's the editor of Absolute Sound. And so I was just like, wow, these guys are like making all these purist recordings with these fancy microphones, and they're listening to these $5,000 speakers, which back then was a lot of money for speakers. And we're talking about early 90s. And so I was like, oh my God, wow, this is like a whole world I didn't know about, all this high-end audio and blah, blah, all these brands I'd never heard of, right? And so, and it was just, Stereophile was a really great read back then. I mean, it was really, really good, I thought. And so I was like, wow, these guys are hearing all these things and stuff. And you know, so I ended up sitting, I went to Marantz digital compact cassette, right? Which was a digital cassette format that was compressed using like one of the early MPEG audio codecs. And David Birch Jones, kind of an industry legend, he's retired now, he was doing the demo. And I ended up sitting right behind Robert Harley. I was like, oh, wow, I'm sitting behind Robert Harley. So, and, you know, they're doing the demo. And I just, like, sat down behind him and listened to it. And back then, David was playing, like, CD versus digital compact cassette to see if, you know, if you could, you know, what the sonic comparison was. And I listened to it, and I'm like, oh, I can definitely hear the codec. It sounds good, but I can hear the codec. You know, you could hear, like, a little bit of loss of, you know, space, a little bit of loss of, you know, maybe some treble detail and stuff, but it still sounded good. And so then I read in Stereophile like 2 months later, because you know, it used to be like the show report came out like months after the show happened. And, you know, Robert Harley was saying he could like barely hear a difference. I'm like, wait a minute. I heard the difference. And it kind of made me realize like, maybe these guys aren't like as magical as I think they are. So, and that kind of led me down the path to like my current attitude of like, there is a certain thing of like knowing what to listen for and all that, but a lot of this stuff is grossly exaggerated. And there's a lot of things. I mean, if you read any of these magazines, there's really dysfunctional products that you can look at the measurements and tell this thing's got problems. And then the reviewer doesn't hear it, you know, most of the time.
I have a question off of that.
Mm-hmm.
Back when I used to read your stuff, I told you before, what I really liked about it is you always put it, you talked about like high end stuff. You talked about all these different things that maybe were over people's heads, mine in particular at the time. You don't understand it, but you always brought stuff back down to, there was stuff in there that I could relate to. You brought it down to being relatable at some point. So your articles, the way you wrote always seemed to relate to every level of knowledge. Okay. Today, based off of what you were saying, because of the internet, because it's not just like in magazines like Home Theater or Stereophile or Audiophile or whatever, you can get information everywhere. And to your point, Brent, people are saying stuff. It's like, and what I'm thinking and what I'm hearing, it's, and what a lot of people don't understand is that it's what you don't say is almost as powerful as what you do say. So what you were just saying there is people saying like, oh, I really didn't hear anything there, when maybe they did, but now this is the, I hate doing this, but it's a fact. That's that conflict of interest. Do they have a contract with a competitor? Do they have something else? And it's, you know what I mean? So they can just be like, oh, they're not saying really anything bad. But it's like, it's so hard nowadays because so many people are talking to discern what's the truth, what's not the truth. And it's, do you see what I mean? It's like, it's so hard for people, and especially for newer people, they don't know what they don't know. So they like, they glom onto something, and it's tough.
Yeah. Well, especially with like the influencer thing happening so much now. And some of these influencers, I have to say, you know, by influence, I mean, you know, YouTube people. Some of them are really among the most serious and committed audio journalists that have ever walked the earth. And yet there's a lot of influencer stuff where it's completely not. And it's just, and you know, they're doing it for, you know, maybe it's an outlet for them. Maybe they're getting some free stuff. Maybe they're making some money on it. But you never know where, I mean, we all have conflicts of interest, right? I mean, there's like public relations people I like, you know, and maybe I want to be, you know, I try not to be like this, but you know, maybe deep down inside, I don't want to trash their product as much as I might like to. I don't currently work for an advertising supported publication, do I? Maybe an occasional freelance project, but you know, when you work for an advertising supported publication, you know, there's always that concern, even if they say there's not, you still may have it in the back of your head. I mean, when I was writing for Sound and Vision, nobody ever once said anything to me about like, let's cover this advertiser or something. But still, it's like, if somebody's buying the back cover, you might be a little more cautious about,
right?
You know, you might not say, you know, this is a, well, you wouldn't say it's a piece of crap. You might be a little more restrained in your statements, et cetera. Look, everybody who writes about or critiques anything is going to have some conflicts of interest somewhere. And it's the publications there. It's not so much now. I think it's kind of quaint, but like a lot of audio publications 20 years ago or something used to really pound their chest about how much integrity they had. And you'd sit there and you'd know from having heard stories from manufacturers or from knowing people that worked there or whatever, that it's a bunch of baloney.
Yeah.
So you really have to, I mean, honestly, if you look at a publication like Stereophile, and stop me if I'm going on too long, because as Dennis knows, I can go on forever, and then he has to edit it out.
Well, you're done. I'm throwing it to Dennis, and then I'll have my thought. I'm like, this is great.
Nope.
Anyway, you look at something like Stereophile, right? And they will run a review. And of course, you know, usually the writer is going to be like, oh, you know, great. Lots of inner detail, whatever. A veil was lifted, blah, blah, something or another. And yeah, not always, but you know, 9.5 times out of 10, the writer is going to basically say the product's really good. But then John Atkinson will measure it and be kind of like, you know, this product's got a lot of problems. And they run it, and that shows a lot of integrity. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I will say, as a measurement guy, it's easier to have integrity when you're a measurement guy, because it's a little hard to argue with the measurements. You can if you really know what you're talking about, but you know, there are flaws in John Atkinson's measurement process, but he knows what they are and he talks about what they are. There are flaws in everybody's measurement process, but And that shows really like integrity. And yeah, they're definitely going to be cheerleaders for high-end audio. But then you get into something like, you know, the Absolute Sound or some of the other publications. And it's more just like, oh my God, these cables are mind-blowing and new layers of inner detail, micro something. And every review is just this effusive, like, oh my God, this thing, you plug this amplifier in and it powers a speaker? Oh my God. Incredible.
And don't forget, they just could not bring themselves to send it back. So they purchased the review sample.
Of course.
I mean, if that were actually true, every time I read that, these people would have to have rent out an entire climate controlled storage facility, not just one locker. I mean, they would have more gear than a museum. So.
Right.
And of course they're going to get a discount on it. So, that can be a giant discount or it can be, 15%, but still they're probably going to get a discount on it. And so what does it really mean? What does it mean when their wife came in from the other room and said like, oh my God, I'm great. I don't know.
Yeah. like I just said.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people forget what conflict of interest means. It's not necessarily with you. It's people's perception, right? So like, that's what you try to avoid. It's hard to do that. And like you said, everybody has conflicts of interest and it's, you know, it was very hard for me here. It's like, I tried to do my thing. I don't review stuff. I do my thing. Like I'm trying to do this like I did before I had a podcast. Right. Like I buy the stuff I really like, the stuff that I get advice on from people I trust. And that's what I do. And then I talk about that here. And an interesting thing kind of transpired. My listeners all knew how I felt about screens for my projector. Right. Mm-hmm. I go to Cedia. My perspective changed. We don't have to get into all of that. But one of my listeners in a Patreon chat asked me, since meeting Chris Seymour of Seymour AV Screens, he's like, since meeting him, and I went to dinner with him, we were in a whole group. I got to meet him, talk to him, hung out with him. Great. My wife really liked him. There you go, Brent. I just said that line too. So he was on the show.
But did she come from the other room? That's the important
thing. No. We had just come out of the room, right? Anyways, to me, when you meet somebody, when you get to know somebody, it does change your opinion, right? It's like, I play hockey. You play against somebody. You literally might have fought him. He's on your team. You're best friends, right? Perceptions change. They're great screens. There's a bunch of great screens out there. If you can get to know somebody or you get to know a product or a company or what they stand for, it has nothing to do with measurements. That's just, it's going to skew your opinion. And you're crazy to say that it doesn't. You're like, nope, has nothing to do with it. Like, that's the screen I'm going to get. Chris doesn't know yet. I haven't talked to him. I haven't talked to him since then. But that is the screen I want to get. I want to support that. I liked him. I met him. I do that for if I meet somebody and they guide me in a direction away from themselves, like their product, they'd be like, okay, maybe you don't need this right now. Go here. Or they try to downsell you. That's a huge flag to me. That's awesome. Instead of upselling you on something you don't need, they downsell you to what you should get.
Yeah.
That's a trot. And you're like, I like that product. I like that company. Stuff like that happening. And it's like, that's how, instead of just constantly being upsold or, you know, do it for other reasons besides, that's why I open with like, I didn't mean to go in this direction, but measurements aren't the be all end all because some of that stuff we can't even perceive.
Oh,
but they keep you honest, you know. I mean, look, I'm reviewing a streamer now from Arcam. Arcam, the company that I very, very much love. And it's funny, I admit that in the intro. I have a built-in affection for this brand, right? Mm-hmm. There's some problems with the streamer. Unfortunately, I don't love it. But it's got two different reconstruction filters for the DAC, right? And I'm listening to them and trying to describe the difference. And, of course, you only really hear it with CD resolution stuff. But one of the things I'm saying in the review is, like, Filter 2 sounds to me like it's rolling off somewhere starting between like 10 and 15K, right? My hearing really runs out after that anyway, so I wouldn't be able to say anything. But I feel more confident making proclamations like that because I know then this piece of gear is going to go to Diego Estan, our measurement specialist. And that's going to be a check on me. It's going to be an honesty check, right? But it's mm-hmm. also going to be confirmation. So, you know, I mean, I am sort of constantly getting to do the thing that we talk about all the time, correlate objective measurements with listing impressions. I make my listing impressions first, then we get the measurements. Do they stack up? Did I screw up? Did I miss something that I should have heard? Or, you know, is there something that I heard that is not reflected in the measurements? And that constant feedback loop of knowing that my work is going to be checked. Like, I'd be lying if I didn't say that is an influence on keeping me honest and giving me more confidence to say things that I might not have said otherwise. So,
yeah. And that's, it's also a way of, developing your acuity, right? For mm-hmm. here, like you hear something and it like over the years of you doing that, Dennis, it's like, okay, I was right on this. I heard it. I did this. It checked out or even if you were wrong, well, now you're going to remember that next time. Right. Yeah. And it's people like you guys doing that year after year after year after year, learning it as opposed to I've been doing stuff not to that degree, but I have my level of acuity for what I want though. I'm not a reviewer. This is what I want in my room. I know what I like. And it's fun to, for me, it's fun to do that. And it's fun when you realize it, like all of a sudden you'd be like, oh wow, I can hear certain things that I didn't even know existed before and stuff like that. You know, I think people take too much in, they put too much stock in everybody else and not enough. They don't trust themselves. I think they got to start, like, they take other people's opinions, but ultimately it's what do you like? Dennis just dropped. What do you like?
I'll carry on his role.
Yeah, there you go.
Get back on.
He's back.
There he is.
Don't know what happened.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not worried. I've been around long enough. I'm not worried about anybody telling me these, you know, the evolution pinnacles don't measure up. And I'm not worried about it. If something came through and it's like, oh, well, there's an issue here or there. It's like, there's also a price point thing. There's a level of quality that I'm looking for. It's like, I'm not looking for $20,000 speakers. I'm looking for in this price range and this, you know, so. That's what, you know, for me, there's multiple reasons to own my pieces, whether it's speakers, projectors and stuff like that.
But then again, like SVS is not an unknown quantity. You go into a pair of SVS speakers knowing probably the tonal response is going to be good. The distortion is going to be low. The dispersion is going to be good. The crossovers are going to be well designed. Like, you can kind of take those things for granted. I mean, somebody like me, I still want the confirmation, but generally speaking, SVS puts out a new speaker. You can be pretty confident it's going to be well designed, right? It's going to sound good. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, now, getting into, like, you guys had mentioned this, I don't know when, but status purchases, building off of what we're talking, like, do you think a lot of people are buying, I think you said it, I'm just kind of leading you in that direction, like, they buy this stuff, but they don't even know why. They just buy it because it's that status. Like, they know that they're going to have that in their room and be like, it's like, I've talked to friends that do that in multiple hobbies, not just home theater or audio or anything. And they're like, look at that. It's like, do you know why you bought that? What do you know what that means? Like it, and too many people are doing that and then going on the internet and saying why you should get it, but they don't know why.
Well, that happens across industries. Like it's hard to think of an industry that doesn't have that issue. You know, I mean, you see these people with these giant pickup trucks now that where the hood of the pickup truck is like 5 feet high. And it's not really, I mean, I've owned a couple of pickup trucks and used them as, you know, pickup trucks, like put things in them and carry them places. And you don't want the bed of your pickup truck to be that high, right?
Oh, I know.
But it's the status of having this thing that lifts you way up that, even though it's completely impractical, that's the big trend now. And it's purely status. And the same thing with, but we're all guilty of that. Like, what's a good example of something around here? I mean, obviously not clothing, but, with any kind of, like music gear that I buy, right? Like if I buy, strings for my bass, right? Which for a double bass are really expensive. They can be anywhere from, $100, but typically more like $200, even as high as $500 or $600 a set. And, I kind of like to buy more of the name brandy kind of ones that are like $200 because I feel, even on, like most bass players, I kind of experiment with different strings stupidly, but you kind of do. And, I don't want the ones that are like $150, $100, even though they might work fine. I'm just kind of scared of them. I kind of feel like, that's just not, I need to spend more. I'm just not going to get what I really need by cheaping out. And that's the whole reason for, expensive cables. It's like someone comes up with an expensive cable and people are like, oh, wait, I can get a cable that works for, I don't know, 20 cents a foot or something. Or, but there's this guy who's selling cables for hundreds of dollars or more. And, maybe I just need something a little better. And it just kind of, we all have to buy the things that make us feel good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's my thing. I want people, I want, like what I try to get across here with this show is go with your gut, go with your feelings, because ultimately that's what is going to make you happy. And when you do that, and I think you guys would agree, it lessens FOMO so much, right? Because you're not looking, like if you did it for a reason other than measurements or something like that, like you went with your gut and you're like, I really like this because of, and as like I was saying before, I have multiple reasons for it. You never look back over your shoulder going, did I make the right decision? You're like, you have a reason. You're happy with it because you went with your gut and you're good with it. And then maybe you'll grow into it and you'll learn something later and be like, now maybe I want to upgrade or something.
Well, I'll say this. Like for me, one of the things that's important to me when trying to help people make purchasing decisions. I mean, ideally, I would hope that they are well-informed, that these purchasing decisions are built on a foundation of knowing what they need to know. But I'll tell you, my bigger concern is a fear that people are making purchasing decisions based on not a lack of information, but a surplus of misinformation, right?
Yeah.
And that's a lot of times what I'm fighting against. If people just are utterly convinced of kooky things with no basis in reality. Look, there is a valid argument to be made that, well, who cares? It's their money that they're wasting. Let them waste it. But my thing is, but no, they're leading other people astray, right? they are creating, they are perpetuating this silly cycle. So if you can just fight against misinformation in the attempt to inform people better, right, then I think their gut is going to lead them towards smarter purchases. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's what I'm trying to do here with that. Like you said, my son-in-law is going through it right now. He's 20 and he's going to be going through it for a long time until you get a good, I mean, he has me, but I don't want to give him all, like, I don't want to tell him the correct answers. I want him to, cause it's easy. It's like, you can, I don't know, teach a horse to drink or drink it. I don't know what the hell the story is, but you know what I mean? I'd rather.
I don't think you're supposed to drink horses.
No, whatever. You know.
Okay.
It's like, and this is why I don't want to give them the information. I'm not very bright either. So, but you know what? It's better to, especially that's part of the hobby. You know, he's big into everything. He loves to tinker with everything. He tinkers with home theater. He tinkers with motorcycles. He tinkers with everything. And it's, I think, using him as an example, because I think it's a great example, people now feel like it's easy because I'll just go on the internet, YouTube it, and I'll find the answer. It might be the wrong answer for you. It might be the wrong answer for what you need. You're better served to try and do something with it and learn. And so, was this right? Was that right? You know, and I mean, there are some answers, but like you said, that misinformation, and you had mentioned it a while about it, Dennis, about like this, I don't necessarily agree with you that the hobby's dying, either of them, home theater or audiophiles, like that we're not getting as many in as there were losing. You said something like that. But the idea that this misinformation, or you need to have an extravagant system to be in this hobby, you don't. And it's like, it's that information that turns this into a non-starter for people. I think that's a huge piece of misinformation. How difficult this is a huge piece of misinformation. If you look at like my theater and said, well, that's so hard to do. Well, yeah, but it took me 30 years to get here. That's the end for me. Not the end, but it's, you know what I mean? It's like, but that's the hard part to get to. And it's, how do you combat it? Because you got to get the people to listen to, you know, the right things. And that's why I like you guys' show. It's like you do it in a fun way. And it's just, it really, really does bother me. All that misinformation. It's funny you even just said it, but yeah.
So, I'm kind of going through this right now. I'm getting my first proper grown-up adult turntable, right? And this process started like 6 months ago, right? Me trying to figure out what to buy. And I researched it for about a month and realized I was more confused than when I started. Just because so much of the rhetoric surrounding vinyl turntables is, in my opinion, misinformation. So I was like, it's funny. The most sensible advice I got from anybody was from Brent, who was like, I like turntables with MDF plants, and you should probably get an Ortofine cartridge. And it's just like, damn, that's actually reasonable, actionable advice. Whereas so much of what I was hearing from people just, I don't know, like I said, it made me more confused than when I started researching. So.
Yeah. What's the, Brent, you got to go? Oh, I was just going to ask you something. It's tough. It's tough. And you get questions. I get questions. People come in and they're like, oh, well, this guy says this. And you're like, he's not wrong. It just doesn't fit to what you're saying. Like, there's answers that, like I said earlier, there's answers to things that it's what they're not saying that's missing. Like, I'll give you an example. I saw a shoot. This was years ago, so I don't have to talk about who did the shootout or whatever, but they did a shootout with two projectors. Two different brands, but they put one brand, their top of the line, up against the middle of the line of the other brand. And basically what they did, so it's a top of the line projector for one brand, the middle of the line for the other brand, and they...
Were they comparably priced?
No. No. Oh, one was twice the price of the other one. Okay? So what they did is... And you, oh boy, here we go.
Yay.
So, but what they were doing is, and what most people didn't realize is this was a promotional piece for the middle of the line brand. Because what they did is they said, here we go. We're not calibrating these. What we're going to do is we're going to, out of the box, we're going to set everything to 50% and we're going to give you our honest review on what we see, side by side comparison. And they were like, the black levels on the middle of the line one far superior to the top of the line one and blah, 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 blah. And everybody's like, oh my God, the black levels horrible on that brand, blah, 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 blah. And they were like, the opening piece was, it's not calibrated. The top of the line at 50% is a light cannon. Your black levels are going to be crap side by side with the lower powered middle. Of course, the middle of the line is going to be. And it's stuff like that that people.
Why didn't they calibrate? Was there any justification for it? Or
I'm telling you, and that's what I got multiple people emailing me like, see, this is this. Either people questioning it or telling me this is why this brand's better or this is this. And you're like, it's a promotional piece because what they're doing is they're promoting that brand in the middle.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay that. Look at this top. It would have been better. It would have been more accurate if they used the same brand and did the exact same thing. Why didn't they? Because it was a promotional piece on that brand in the middle, which also has a projector that goes with the other one. But it was horrible. When you do a comparison and you say we're not calibrating it, what the hell? Like, that's the point, because especially when they're not comparable pieces. You know what I mean? They're like, we're not going to calibrate these two cars, but watch this Honda Accord go up against this Ferrari, you know, and we're going to have it do this and be like, which is better at commuting back and forth to Boston? Well, the Ferrari broke down 25 times. Well, yeah, because it's not supposed to be doing that every day.
So, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's that kind of misinformation that's, you know, like, it was an ad piece disguised as a shootout.
Yeah.
So, what do you guys see? What's your, like, as you were leaving, Brent, what, popping out for a second? Do you have a piece of misinformation that you don't like? A trend or something that you see? I'm trying to get you.
Oh, I got to think about that. Dennis, do you have anything? Give me a second.
You would like him when he's angry.
I know.
He's the credible Hulk. You would like him when he's
the
angry.
The credible Hulk. I like that. I like that. I like that.
Oh, you know, actually, no, I can think of one thing right now, but it's kind of a dated reference. I was looking at I did an article about the resurgence of cassette, I think 3.5 years ago on Wirecutter. And I normally go back on what, but it's not a guide. It's just a blog, right? So I normally on my guides, I go back whenever I have a chance and look at the comments. So I answer people's questions and maybe defend criticism of me and things like that. Or maybe sometimes they're like, hey, why haven't you tested this? I'm kind of like, I didn't know it existed, but we'll get it in. But in this case, it was cassettes. And I was basically like, look, you know, these things don't sound good. That's all there is to it. And they were, you know, it's like, yeah, sound comes out of them. But compared to streaming, they're just not good, much less CD or anything like that, right? It's a lot of high frequency roll off. There's not much bottom octave bass, you know. These are just facts, okay? And one guy on there, and so I had not looked at that article in probably a couple of years, and one guy on there was calling me an effing idiot and all this stuff, and how he heard cassette and you know, he thinks it's better. And one guy was like, well, this guy's clearly never used a Nakamichi deck because Nakamichi's the best and blah, 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 blah. All of this just nonsense. And, you know, it's like, you know, I grew up with cassette. You know, I got how many cassette things have I owned? And I worked for Dolby, for God's sake. I mean, Ray Dolby. Okay. And it's like, and these guys like are just buying into all this mystique. You know, my friend Gordon Soap up at Innovative Audio, which is a vintage audio dealer in Vancouver, Canada. You know, he's dealt with lots of Nakamichis. You can probably buy a Nakamichi in his store along with 10, 15, 20 other different cassette decks. And he's like, you know, they're fine, but they go out of calibration a lot. They're not that reliable. He's like, they're really not any better than anything else out there. But these guys think, oh my God, you got to get the Nakamichi. And I hate that brand loyalty thing, because all these brands, all these companies, go through changes. I mean, we've all been around long enough to know that these companies go through changes. And a brand name means something, maybe, like we're talking about SBS, okay? Well, it means something. I mean, they've generally made really good stuff. I mean, but if you're like, oh, SVS is the best, well, yeah. Define best and compared to what and for what purpose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And I really hate that brand loyalty because, oh, God, I have one dude. All right, I'm going off now. I have one dude who I reviewed a piece of Parasound gear one time. I think for – who was that thing we used to write for, Dennis?
Home Theater Review. Yeah.
And so like some guy got on there and said, and it was like maybe a Parasound amp or something. I can't remember. And some guy got on there and said, just don't pair Parasound with JBL. I did that 20 years ago and it was very, you know, I'm just like, dude, none of those people work for those companies anymore. Yeah. Hardly. Like the people that design that gear are probably gone, and there's different people. Are people who are like, no highs, no lows, must be Bose. Like, that phrase was coined back, the people that worked at Bose back when that phrase were coined are all dead or retired. Okay? Yeah. It's like yes, go ahead.
Talking about SBS.
Yeah. Right?
If they sell to some, you know, Bain Capital equivalent tomorrow, all bets are off. I reassess immediately, right? Because soon as the new, you know, capital firm comes in as the owner, the history means nothing to me anymore.
Right. So. Yeah. There can be like, you know, sweeping changes that could do something. Absolutely. Because it
happened to Paradigm, man. And, they have found their way back home. They have found their way back on track. But for a while there, it was kind of icky, you know, and I say that as a huge Paradigm fanboy. So.
Yeah.
And media outlets, obviously. I mean, CNET got bought by Venture Capital and they have had a rocky road ever since then. Whereas they used to be they're still good people there, but that used to be sort of, I think in some ways, the gold standard of sort of mainstream audio and video product reviewing. And, you know, venture capital buys it and guys who are good at figuring out how to make money, but not necessarily good at actually running a business that makes its customers happy, get in there and start moving things around and the good people, a lot of the good people will leave or they just start doing dumb stuff or who knows what. And no, I really don't believe in brand loyalty, although, you know, it does mean something, right? Like you probably would be more likely to buy a LG soundbar than a Sony soundbar, right? You'd probably be more likely to buy that than some Chinese brand you've never heard of, right? Even though I haven't been that impressed with Sony soundbars, to tell you the truth. I remember a day when Samsung was generally considered to be cheap junk. And Samsung was saying, well, we're going to be the next Sony. And everyone's just rolling their eyes. And now Samsung is, you know, the next Sony, to say the least. And, so it just doesn't really... You know, Arcam, we were just talking about. Arcam's effectively owned by Samsung now. What does it mean? I don't know. Is it better? Is it worse? You know, some of those brands get better if they get bought by a big company. I mean, Beats is a lot. Beats, everyone just says, oh, Beats, you know, they used to say Beats is garbage. And they were right. Right?
Yeah. And now, not at the beginning though, right? Didn't they, you guys talk about Beats a lot. You got, because they did do that wave. Didn't they come out really well? Then they got bought and like, they got commercialized, went way downhill. Is that, and now they're back. Is that right?
No.
Not in my experience, no.
Or did they start out commercialized? I don't remember. Did they start out commercialized and then get improvements?
No, they started out trash. There's still
pretty
some
trash.
About who voiced those original headphones, but they were super bassy. And I mean, literally the worst set of headphones I've ever heard, I think, is the Just Beats. And the ones that were like done in conjunction with Justin Bieber. And oh, they were so bassy. There was like no top end at all. They rolled off at like, I don't know, 5K or something. They're just horrible. And I remember their first Bluetooth speaker was so bad that a competing manufacturer called me up and said, hey, have you heard the Beats Pill? I'm like, no. He says, and he happened to live in LA. He says, I'm bringing it over now. And he brought it over to my house. And he played it. It's like, I can't believe how bad this is. And I pulled, as he was probably hoping, I pulled out all my measurement gear and started running measurements on it. It was just brutally bad. I mean, now Apple bought them though, and they brought in Beats started to get good engineering before Apple bought them. They started to actually hire engineers as opposed to just buying stuff from China, which is really what they were doing. And as far as I understand it, from people that were actually involved in the process, whom I know, but you know, they were starting to get better and they were starting to get more serious. Then Apple bought them, and Apple has, you know, pretty world class audio engineering. I mean, are they the best headphones I've ever heard? No, but they're respectable, you know, and they're all of their speakers are respectable, you know. So anyway, what were we talking about? Branding.
Branding, so, brand loyalty and stuff. And
yeah, but if you say Beats sucks based on headphones that happened 15 years ago, that's pretty ridiculous because none of those people are involved with Beats products anymore. It's all done at Apple.
Yeah. So brand loyalty, anybody listening to this, I would imagine doesn't have a lot of brand loyalty. Brand loyalty to me is for people that's where they end their research, right? Like you said, like I know Sony's a good company. They've put out good product. I don't care the difference between one to the other. So I know I'm getting something good. So I'm going to go with the Sony regardless of what I say, you know, what you think.
Sure.
People listening to my stuff, my show and your show, is they're listening, they're researching, right? And it's regardless, they may have some brand loyalty, but they'd be swayed with some measurements or with some knowledge of this company is going down a little bit right here because they got bought out or they did this or they did that, you know? So it's like I early on in my show, people was like, oh, you love X because that's what I had in my system. But I've never been brand loyal. I've been opinion loyal to the people that I trust. And all my pieces have been rotated over the years of like, whether it's my receiver, my displays or the only thing that was consistent was I had my NHT speakers for like 25 years.
Oh, okay.
And then everything revolved around that. So it was, you know, speaker cable. Did they look good? Did they have good color? You know, did they look good going into the back? I was like, you know, that was like 16 gauge copper. What did they look like if I needed aesthetics? Right. So it's, I think for most people listening to our stuff, brand loyalty doesn't, it shouldn't. If they are going brand loyal, this is our pitch. Don't.
Well, but I do still have brand affections though.
Absolutely. You know, I said that about Chris Seymour,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you get to a certain level, you're going to say like, what's the difference? Now you can lean on a brand that way, but you're getting to a certain level and you have your knowledge. And then you're like, really, what's the difference between these two? Why am I going to pick this one over that one when they're so damn close? That's where it comes to. I don't think that's brand loyalty. That's more like personality or like, I don't know. It's not the brand itself. That's smaller company stuff, right? To me, like I don't know anybody at Sony, so I wouldn't be like, I just really like the way they do business. What, billions? Like I don't know how they, you know what I mean? It's different. It's like it's a different situation there.
Well, and there's also a certain amount of, you know, pride of ownership. And if I had to buy a few new cassette players coming out, which we're testing for Wirecutter right now. And, you know, would I rather have a Sony cassette player than a Byron Statix cassette player. Yes, absolutely. Even if it's just a plasticky piece of junk, and even if they probably use the same transport. You know, and there's a lot of times when I would rather have a Sony something than a lesser known brand, just because more pride of ownership. I mean, this is how, you know, a sort of related industry. I mean, this is how Gibson sells guitars. You know, I mean, is a Gibson guitar actually better than, say, an Epiphone, which is its sister brand? Very questionable, but it's many multiples of the price. It's going to be 3 times the price of the Epiphone, maybe 4 or 5 times the price of the Epiphone. And yeah, same with all sorts of different things in musical instruments. It's like there's a lot of really good musical instruments you can get for cheap. And, you know, I would say usually now it's spending a whole lot more doesn't matter, except people still do because they want, you know, a Gibson instead of an Epiphone, right? It's a status symbol.
Yeah. I mean, there's, if you know why you're doing it, like I said, there's nothing wrong with that. It's form over function sometimes for some people, it should be function, really.
You want the Bose or Sony headphones over the Soundcore headphones, even though, you know, this Bose or Sony is going to be 2 to 3 times the price. And are they going to be better? Probably not. But, you know, Soundcore has, you know, more or less equivalent performance. Except, you know, you want a brand that people will recognize. And if it says Bose on the side, people are going to think, oh, this guy can afford Bose, or this guy, you know, has Sony. Whereas if they have some brand you don't recognize, it's going to be kind of like, I mean, I would hope people have something better to do than look at other people's brands of headphones they're wearing. But it's more like you want to think that, I mean, I look because I'm in the business, but you know, you still just feel better about yourself. Even stupid earphones, which no one looks at, you're going to feel better about yourself if you have something cool, like, I don't know, Campfire Audio or something, instead of, you know, some cheap, you know, some the JBLs I have in my briefcase, which are like $20, right? You'd rather have the fancy ones because you feel like, oh, this is, you know, this is something special. This makes me feel special because I have the Campfire Audio ones, and I do like Campfire Audio in general. But yeah, I'd rather have that than probably these JBLs, even though these JBLs certainly better than some of, for my taste, better than some of what Campfire has, and not as good as some of what Campfire has.
Would you like to add, Dennis? Because I have something.
Oh, no. Okay. I think I'm just sitting here nodding going.
Yeah, okay. speak of headphones, I recently, because building a house and stuff, I don't listen to as many podcasts anymore. I get distracted, right? I'll go down rabbit holes listening to podcasts, listening to home theater podcasts. Listen, you guys, I don't go down rabbit holes on though, because you're so, like, you just rip stuff about and I laugh. It's more of a comedic hour for me about the information of home theater and audio and stuff. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, your knowledge isn't comedic. It's just how you do it. So, but
like I amuse you.
Yeah, you do. You do. I'm, you're not going to scare me. I'm going to lean into it. Yeah. I crack up listening to you guys. You had one, I think it was the last show you had. I think one guy's like, I love your show. I love the way you guys do things. And then he criticized you and said, guys, relax. I'm like, these two guys couldn't relax more. I'm like, you open with their relax. Why are you ending with relax? I was like, what the hell? But anyways,
yeah.
I've just been constantly listening to podcasts, right? So headphones to me really meant nothing. I work alone all day. It's usually one ear piece in and that's it. So all I need to do is hear whoever's talking. So quality doesn't matter, right? But in the last few months, I'm starting to listen to more music. you know, listening to, you know, Pandora, listening to my iTunes, listening to this. And like, and I own, the Bose, earbuds, you know, they're whatever, they're like $300-something earbuds, the noise canceling earbuds. Those are fantastic noise cancellation. I have the iPod Pro earbuds. Those are fantastic noise cancellation, not as good as the Bose, right? But now, and I also have where they were down here, I have the Maxes, iPod Maxes for, you know, traveling. I now with music, I'm starting to hear the difference. And I honestly, I think the Bose stink. They're like you said earlier, Brent, about what was one that was too bassy. They're too, I can't get the clarity that I can get with the Apples, anything from Apple. It just, it doesn't. And the other thing I'm noticing too is in my cars now, and it's been a long time since I've listened to this much music in a row, like every day, all day, what I'm listening to. And remember back, I started in car audio with my first car and stuff, and everybody, you want all that bass in your car. But now with my history of home theater and knowing how to get bass right, I'm turning the bass down and I'm upping like the mids a little bit, and I'm up it in. The clarity is so much better. The punch in the bass feels more like when I'm in my theater, and it's like it takes that boom out of the car. Now I'm used to hearing that, and I want that in my ears too, because I don't want the boom in your ears just distracts from the clarity of the rest of the track. Thoughts? Am I on to something or am I wrong?
Well, no, this is something that I think a lot of people don't know. And this was taught to me by a guy named Peter Tribeman, who was the founder of Atlantic Technology and also founded Outlaw Audio and worked for NAD and some other brands and for Henry Close in whatever thing he did at the time. And, you know, he told me, God, like 30 years ago, that when you boost the bass, it also has the subjective effect of cutting the treble. And likewise, when you boost the treble, it has the subjective effect of cutting the bass, even though you haven't touched those frequencies. And it's true. And I think that the people that are really good at voicing headphones and Bluetooth speakers in particular, I mean, with a good bookshelf speaker, you don't have to compromise on either, right? But, you know, with headphones, you're going to have some high frequency roll off. With Bluetooth speakers, you're going to have low frequency issues. And so that's the thing, is if something's too bassy, it's going to sound dull, even though you didn't do anything to the treble. And if it's something's too trebly, or even if you roll off the treble, it's going to sound like you boosted the bass. And getting that balance right is the hardest part of voicing audio gear. Especially, you know, not as big of a deal with speakers. Cause like I said, you know, it's not too hard to make a reasonably full range speaker, but with headphones, Bluetooth speakers, sound bars, things like that, getting that balance of the bass and treble right is the biggest deal in voicing these products. And I consulted on a lot of this stuff, and I would tell some of my clients that, and they'd ignore me, but I was right. And I did one Bluetooth speaker, and it had huge low frequency problems. It was actually an electrostatic Bluetooth speaker with a couple of dynamic woofers, right? And it was a really cool product, but because the panels, the little tiny electrostatic panels didn't have a lot of output, I said, look, you have to, or actually I should say that the little tiny woofers didn't have a lot of output. I said, you have to roll off the treble and then it'll sound balanced. And we did. And I went back and forth with their engineers, and they kind of pushed back a lot. But at the end of the day, they're kind of like, well, the guy who was in charge of the US division of it was like, yeah, you're right. This sounds better. But then I think the engineers didn't agree with me. And so they got some Japanese audiophile consultant dude who made them flat to 20K, and they sounded like they had no bass. And so a lot of people really do think that you have to be like flat to 20K all the time and all this stuff. It's just wrong. It's like this stuff has to be sculpted to sound good within its limitations.
Okay. And now is that on headphones, you mean?
On everything. Or headphones, anything? Well, I shouldn't say everything. Even with some big speakers, it's true. I mean, I had some Revels, what was the F206s, and they had like a little bit of bass boost, which I was really surprised at, because they were smaller than the F208s, right? They didn't have as much bass oomph, and yet they made all their speakers flat to 20 and beyond. And so they put a little extra bass in it to counteract, you know, to make up for the fact that it didn't have these big woofers there and to keep it sounding balanced. And I heard it. And the guy who was running Rebel at the time, Kevin Bake, said, he's like, yeah, but it's just like a decibel. I'm like, well, I can hear it, you know. And so I think it's just super critical. And it's something that doesn't get talked about much in audio unless you're that's not talked about in audiophile forums. It's not talked about in mainstream reviews or even most audiophile reviews, but it's something that's known in the industry among the, you know, the consultant class and the people that make these kinds of products. They know this, and it's common in that it's common once you get into the manufacturing side. It's something that reviewers don't understand very well, and I'm sad to say.
Okay. I got, like, you said something there about like flat to 20. I had a discussion probably a month ago, and we went like eyeballs deep into the weeds on different rooms. And basically it was, and you guys had mentioned it in your show, one show about, you know, room treatments for audiophile, not a big deal, something like that. Right. But in home theater, it is a big deal because you're executing two different scenarios here. Audiophile is usually it's two speakers, and that's what you're going for right there. Is you're going for that, you know, stereo sound imaging, and you're literally using the room to, yeah, you know, image the sound, right? In home theater, you're actually trying to eliminate the room because you have so many speakers, the speakers are doing all the imaging for you, right? And with Atmos and everything. So things are moving. You don't want dead on dead room, but you want room treatments, right? So my contention,
yeah, and
I wanted, like I was saying, in a home theater environment, I want flat. Because if I can run 20 to 20K flat in a room, that to me is real. That's real life. There's no roll off in real life. I go out in the field and shoot a gun. Yeah. There's no roll off. It's like, and I'm trying to duplicate reality in my home theater environment. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, in a home theater, you have subwoofers. So there's no reason not to have flat response to 20, because you have any reasonable home theater is going to have enough bass power to counterbalance that, to where you can get a good balanced sound. I was going to say the sort of overlooked, but best, and to me only valid, work that's been done on acoustics is in the Floyd Tool book. And, you know, where they actually blind tested this stuff. Okay. And, you know, and Floyd came to my house one time, cause I called him up, and he used to live close to me, and, I called him up and I had some questions about his book and stuff. And, he's like, well, look, why don't I just come over and I'll take a look at what you got. I said, fine. And, yeah, I bought him a crappy lunch. But, anyway, he comes over and he just looks at the room, and he's like, yeah, do this, do this, do this. And it took him like no time at all. And so basically his findings were, you know, you put, absorptive stuff behind your front speakers, right? And, yeah, a pretty good amount of absorptive stuff. And this works for two-channel audio or home theater. And he said, you can do, he said, for two-channel listening, you really probably don't want sidewall stuff. But for home theater, it's optional. It can have benefits on home theater, like you're saying, where you're getting more of the imaging from the speakers than from the acoustical effects of the room, right?
Right.
And he said, this was the part that surprised me, was he says, you know, yeah, diffusers are really, really good. Well, for either one, but with home theater, you're going to get more of a surround effect, except you want to have an absorptive panel dead center in behind you, or it just starts to sound too, you know?
Yeah.
And he was right. I did all that stuff and piece of cake. I mean, the only thing is, like, for the conflict you tend to get is that to do acoustics right, it's difficult to do it unless you have things that are thick, right? Or they don't work. Like, if you're going to have absorptive material, it needs to be like at least 4 inches thick. And, or else it's not going to absorb enough in the mid range and you're going to, it's going to start to sound kind of shouty. If you're doing diffusers, you know, they need to be something like 8 inches thick to really have a broadband diffusive effect. I mean, he looked at the diffusers I have, which were commercially available diffusers, kind of a so-called skyline diffusers, you know what I'm talking about? Where it looks like a city skyline, kind of.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yep.
Right, it's kind of like thick in the middle and then it kind of a bunch of little random shapes and stuff. And so I had some from, I can't remember the company, but they were, I want to say, 4 or 5 inches thick. And he said, those are excellent tweeter diffusers. But you have to move them out to make them work down into the mid-range. He said, and I said, well, what do I do? He said, just build spacers onto the back of them. They'll work fine. And I did. Yeah, worked. Or, you know, you can do like the old thing of, you know, where you get, you know, concrete forming tubes?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. The big tube that you use that they use to make concrete pilings, right? You can go buy them at Home Depot.
Yeah, sonar tubes. Yep.
Sonar tubes, yeah. And so if you cut those things in half and mount them to your wall, those are great diffusers. But the only problem is to get one that is adequately thick. The thickest ones you can get at Home Depot are the ones that are biggest in diameter are decent. They'll do a decent job of diffusing, but to really nail it, you need to go to a construction supply place, which will cost you a lot more money, and get the ones that are, I think Floyd said 7 inches is the minimum, or was it 8? But I went and got some.
So 16 inch diameter cut in half is what you're looking for.
I can't remember if they were 16 or 14 inch, but you know, they were 2 or 3 times the price of the Home Depot ones, although still, I don't know, $100 or something. And they cut them to lengths for you, so you can get exactly the length that you want. And, you know, I got my saber saw and cut them in half and put some little wood things in the back, and I covered them with fabric so they looked nice, and they were fantastic. They worked as well as anything else you can buy. And I thought they looked cool. You know, my choice of fabric maybe was not what some people would like, but hey, man, you can put whatever, or you can paint them, you know, spray paint them. Whatever turns you on, but you can. I'm rambling on about acoustics, but I don't get to talk about acoustics all that much. So
you have your own show.
Well, I know, but you know, it's a like you said, it's a comedy show.
Yeah. Who's writing your material, Dennis? You got to have them include some acoustic stuff in there.
Now we pick mostly topics where Dennis has something important to say or where I'm likely to rant.
I rarely have anything important to say, so I don't know why you put that one first.
You always have something important. Well, not always, but on many topics you have a wise and reasoned viewpoint.
That I probably learned from you, you know.
Well, maybe, that was probably the viewpoint I had, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but have since abandoned in my old age.
Oh, good point. Good point.
As my brain power declines and I get more, I was telling someone the other day, I'm so old that I really don't like anything but dogs anymore.
I've been that way my whole life. Like I don't like people. People are, it's, I do. I mean, I mean, everybody knows I don't. I'd rather just be, you know, even in public, just leave me alone. But it's, and now that I'm getting older, it's just the grumpiness leaks out. But do you guys, I mean, aside from the fact that you did just recently have your anniversary podcast and Brent took the role of my wife and forgot,
it was like anniversary. What?
Yeah, you know, but the best was it's in what you say. It's if people listening, if you haven't heard it, go to Audio Unleashed. It's literally the last one. Maybe you're hearing this later. What was it? May, some middle of May, right?
Yeah, as we're recording, we have an episode dropping in 38 minutes.
So. Oh, cool. I'll listen to that one. This one won't be out for 2 weeks. So actually, this will be out in, so it's mid-May, whatever it was. It's whatever it was. I'll look it up in a second. But you open the show and Dennis goes, happy anniversary. Brent goes, why? The answer's in the right after happy. It comes right after happy. It was like, why? And you were like, oh, it's our 1 year anniversary. And I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. My question to that is, are you guys having more fun now than you were when you started podcasting? Have you found a groove? You sound like, I can't say you sound like you're having more fun, but I feel like maybe a little looser or like unfettered.
Well, you know, there are a lot of behind the scenes things that people probably don't understand about the podcast, and maybe they don't need to. Hopefully they don't need to. But you know, when we first started podcasting, I was in really rough shape, medically speaking. And one of the reasons we originally started podcasting for Soundstage was our editor was trying to figure out work for me to do that I could do standing up because I couldn't sit. Right. Oh, wow. And I've been battling some really, really rough medical stuff for the past 5 years, and I'm just coming out of it now. So there's some of that. I'm in less pain, but I think the biggest change for me is I'm just less horrified at the sound of my own voice. I am an extreme introvert, right?
You have a great voice, though.
It is impossible for me to convey in words the level of my introversion, and just to be public in this way was horrifying at first. And I would not have been able to do it without Brent. He is my emotional support animal. But now it's the point where I really look forward to it, and I don't mind having my voice out there. And I'm actually able to do things like the video chat that we did, the 24-hour thing with you. That would have been inconceivable for me a few years ago, but Brent wanted to do it. And there are a few places that Brent will go that I will not follow. So I'm just getting more comfortable being, you know, seen and heard, which I've never been comfortable with before. So maybe you're hearing some of that. I don't know.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I had no idea that was going to go there. Why would I know? But that's, you know what I mean?
You like, didn't need to.
That was great. And thank you for you did say that, I think, in the 24-hour show, or Brent said it. He's like, wow, we're getting to see Dennis here. Like, Brent's like, I haven't seen Dennis in like 2 or 3 years or something. I think it was like pre-COVID was the last time you saw him, right, Brent?
At the beginning of COVID. Yeah. I caught COVID on the way home from the last time I saw Brent. And I think I was one of the first two people in Alabama with COVID. So, yeah, the last time I saw him was March of 2020.
Oh, wow. So, and then, in hearing that on the show, I was like, really? Wow. That's, you know, and so, wow, thank you for coming on. It was one of the highlights for me. And that was a long, fun, it was a blast to do. And I can't wait to do it again this year. I can't wait. But,
are you going to get the sponsorship thing up and running this year? Cause I know you said you tried last year and the timing just didn't quite work. So,
So what we're doing this year is we're going to be doing, probably end of May, June, probably by August, I'll get going on the idea of promoting it and stuff. And we're doing it. It's all going to be promoting for Movember. That's what we ended up doing last year because, one of the guys I had on from another podcast, he's been doing Movember for years and I've been supporting him. And then we in the show itself started talking about why he's doing Movember and the meaning for him. It's all about men's health. Then that's what November is about, right? So it just, I mean, it's, if you don't have it, I mean, it was just a perfect fit. Like everything happens for a reason. Like here I am doing this show. I have, because of a dare, not even a dare, like, could you do it? Yeah, I can do it. And then we wanted to tie it to a charity or something. And then right there in the show, it just presented itself. And it was like that. And we actually raised some pretty good money that day just by doing that. After that, we raised like, I don't know, a few, like $500-$700 or something like that, that we put to his charity. And I'm like, now if we can focus and actually come at ahead of time and get some people to like get companies to give some stuff or donate some stuff, whatever we can do to raise more money. And just, so that's what it's going to be about every year. So it'll be fun. It'll be fun. And then I'm going to, you know, probably another idea was, you know, you guys are coming on at such and such a time, who, you know, bid on who wants to join us. Cause we ended up, there were a bunch. I mean, I think when you guys were in, we had a few people in the room, right? There were a few people chatting at a time. And there was one time I had 9 people and we're all just chat. I mean, it just was open ended. I had scheduled all these people thinking everybody would come in, go, but people stuck around, other people. It was so much fun. It was so much fun.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, we're at an hour 25. You got a few more minutes or what do you got? A time limit? What do you got? A
couple more. I got to go to the pharmacy and get some prescriptions so I don't die.
Okay.
Please don't die.
Is talking about Dolby Atmos too long before you go to the pharmacy?
No, that's fine.
Okay. Let's go there. You worked at Dolby, talked about Atmos. I don't think I heard you touch on it. Correct me if I'm just forgetting. My thing is when Atmos, you were there, Brent, you were there at the announcement or whatever it was, right?
Well, I was at the Dolby. I was at the official announcement of Atmos. I didn't work for Dolby at the time.
Right. Right. That's what I
worked
meant.
For Dolby from 2000 to 2002. So back in like the Prologic 2 days. So I was at the official Dolby demo way back in, I don't know, 2000, what was it, 8, 9, Dennis? I can't remember. The official one that they had at Dolby headquarters in LA, or Dolby's headquarters in San Francisco, but they have a big LA building.
I think it was a little later than that. It was more like 2012, wasn't it?
Yeah, because it came out in like 15 in the home.
Yeah. So, but you know, here we are, a long time later, and we're still seeing, there's still so much talk about it. I just saw a John Darko video interviewing Stephen Wilson about it today. I have a project I can't talk about right now. I'm working on an Atmos related project I can't talk about, but I've actually done some production work in Atmos now. And, in fact, there has been Atmos music on the Audio Unleashed podcast.
Yep.
Which you I just that. Did for the, since we do all of our own music. I mean, I just threw in, it was easy enough for me to do something in Atmos there. And I'm not sure that you could really tell because it's all, you know, down mixed to stereo anyway. But, I have really started to come to some new opinions about Atmos from having worked with it. And Dennis and I are the opposite on this. I love Atmos for movies, and I think Atmos has radically improved the quality of soundbars. There are Atmos. I just got this one from TCL. It's a 2.0 soundbar with Atmos, which means nothing. But some of these big bars from Samsung, JBL, people like that, or LG, people like that, you know, with the up-firing drivers, it really makes a big difference in a soundbar. It's really great. And of course, if you can put the ceiling speakers in, that's also great. But as far as music goes, Since almost all music is these days listened to through, say, headphones or Bluetooth, you know, wireless headphones, wireless speakers, or car stereo systems, I don't think Atmos is convincing in any of those situations. If, you know, when we have Atmos cars, which I'm, somebody must have done by now, a car is a good environment for it because you can, I guess they could put ceiling speakers in and you know where you're going to be sitting. So you can do a really good presentation in a car if you're willing to put the speaker drivers in there. But with a wireless speaker, you know, with like a Amazon Echo Studio, which is Atmos enabled, you know, it's got an upfiring driver. The presentation is nothing like the presentation you get on a 7.1.4 system. And likewise on headphones, you know, it kind of doesn't work. You know, you'd need to do something like, you need to have something that measures your head-related transfer function, right? And then, you know, does the Atmos processing with your HRTF compensation built in, then you could make it sound like there's overhead speakers. But there's nothing on the market that does that right now, at least convincingly. There's a thing called the Smith Realizer where you actually put microphones into your ears and you run test tones from like whatever system you've got, and it turns it, it really sounds exactly like a 5.1 or whatever system. But no one has, to my knowledge, come up with a viable way to get this into, you know, standard consumer products. You know, Sony has tried, Creative Labs has tried. I don't know who else has tried, probably several other people, but so far, in my experience, it just hasn't worked. And so Atmos to me just sounds like this sort of swirly, I'm doing hand motions here, but we're just going to be audio. Right? All right. So it's this sort of swirly thing of kind of around your ears as opposed to going into both ears and being hard left, hard right. And maybe some people will like that, but it's the effect's going to be different for every different listener. And as a someone who's a musician as well as a audiophile, I'm kind of like, well, why should I get excited about that as a musician when I don't know what the experience for the listener is going to be? So,
right.
Is that enough to talk about Atmos? Maybe Dennis should weigh in here.
Well, you said Dennis has the opposite opinion.
I mean, the opposite opinion in that I don't like Atmos for movies, but I do like Atmos for music and video games.
That's the exact opposite. But I
fully agree with Brent that I have yet to hear Atmos really, really work on headphones or earphones. I like Atmos music in my home theater system, right? So, but yeah, for whatever reason with movies, it just distracts me. It pulls me out of the viewing experience. It takes my attention away from the screen and takes me out of the movie, turns the movie into more of a extended demo scene or theme park kind of thing.
Amusement park. Yep.
Yeah. I don't dig that, but with music, with a really good music mix, like with the Elton John or God, I know how cliche it is, but like the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon, just the spatial unmasking and hearing distinct elements of the mix that have been spatially co-located before, but are now spread out even more. And so I can hear those distinct elements of the mix, you know, DVD audio and SACD did a lot of that back in the day, but I don't think they really had any clue how to mix music and surround then. And there are still a lot of bad Atmos mixes, but I think people are starting to get better with it and more refined and tailoring the mix to the music to where something like Yellow, that's very aggressive and very inorganic anyway, they can get super aggressive with it. But something that's more ambient, then a lot of times you'll be like, is there anything coming out of the ceiling speakers? Oh, yeah, there kind of is. You know what? I'm going to stop worrying about it and just enjoy the experience. And I like that diversity. But when it works, I think Atmos music in an actual home theater setup is pretty magical. And when it doesn't work, I can just turn it off and listen to the stereo version. So,
true.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super interesting to me, Dennis, because that's like, to me, that's the exact opposite of like how most people feel. They, most people are like, they want it in their movies. That's why they like movies, home theater. That's why they do all of that. They want that. And then you go back to, you get two channel should just be two channel. It should just be feel like it's at, cause that's the way it has always been. And yeah. I'm fascinated. Like, I'm wondering, like, did you grow up with like stereo sound for your movies? And that's just how you feel like that's the way it should be.
Well, I like surround sound for my movies. And there are actually some films whose Atmos mixes I really, really love. Dune, Denis Villeneuve's Dune. I mean, the Atmos is hyper aggressive. It is over the top. It is constant. And yet it works for the film. And, you know, my problem with Atmos mixes for movies is so often I find the mix just does not work for the film. It is something to where this should be more of a, I should be entering into a world and yet I'm pulled out of it. Right. So, my problem with Atmos movie mixes is not principled. It's just the fact that I think so many of them are so poorly done. I think there are more bad mixes than there are good mixes. Now, once we get to the point to where there are more good mixes than bad mixes, I'll be like, yeah, Atmos for movies is great.
All right. Fair. I agree. I mean, I can see exactly what you're saying. It's like, I'm going to give you those two. We'll start with Dune, like you said. Fantastic. They use the Atmos to accentuate the movie. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the audio is part of it. Now, another movie I love that I was dying to get in Atmos and I imported it, Twister. Mm-hmm. You know, the old Twister. I've always said, I'm like, it's a fun mix, but it's not like that to me is not an artistic mix because it's just chaos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, if I hear music and it sounds like a garage, you know, or a garbage can rolling down the stairs, that's not artistic to me because I can roll a garbage can down the stairs.
Right.
What they did in Twister, it was just like, we're just going to throw sounds everywhere. I'm going to make it wrap around the room. There was no, I mean, that's what a Twister feels like. So I guess that it was done, but that doesn't feel artistic to me. Right?
No, Twister has never been an audio experience that made you think you were actually on Bob's Road. You know what I mean?
Right. It was crazy. It was loud. It was fun to be in there. And exactly, like it's a theme park, but it wasn't like, did you hear the detail? That there's no detail. There's like crap going on everywhere. But I guess that's the point. And I do enjoy it. I'm not knocking it, but I get your point, Dennis, where it's like, just because it's Atmos and you could, there are places where it's done artistically well, and there are, you know, but most isn't. Yeah. And I can't argue with that. I probably mostly agree with that. I just like it all.
Yeah.
But my other thing about Atmos was, well, my point was, is it possible, and I wanted to ask you guys this, is it possible that the music industry is trying to push that way because it's infinitely compatible? Meaning, like, if you have a two-channel system, it'll play it. If you have a 22-channel system capable of it, it'll play it just as accurately. Whereas if you don't have Atmos, it's not going to be as translatable. Because when I first heard of Atmos, before it even came out, that's what it was touted as. It's like, it's not based on how many speakers or the sound designer was using to make this mix. Like, remember the old Blu-rays and DVDs, this is a 5:1 mix. Oh, this is a 7:1 mix, or this is a 6:1 mix. This is Atmos. It can, if you have a 5:1 mix, it's going to play great. If you have a 7:1 mix, it's going to play great. If you have a 7:1:4 mix, it's going to play great. Do you see what I mean? Is that possible? Why they're trying to push in that direction?
I don't know. I just assumed it was buzzwordy, you know?
That could be it too.
I can tell you why the whole push is happening. And they actually talk about this in the Darko video with Stephen Wilson, is that this was not a Dolby decision. This was an Apple decision. And Apple wanted something to make its streaming service different, right? Because streaming services are basically all the same. And so Apple landed on Atmos. And Dolby and Apple already have a pretty close relationship anyway. So Apple wanted something different something it could market. And granted, Amazon also has Atmos stuff, but Apple's the one that's really pushing it. And Stephen Wilson talks in there about how Apple is really pushing all the record companies to do their entire catalog in Atmos. And Apple's actually offering a higher royalty if your entire catalog is in Atmos. And so the record, that's why he's getting a lot of work now, is the record companies are really pushing to do this so that they get more money, because, you know, it's a worthwhile investment, because you can do an Atmos mix for whatever you want to spend. I can do them. If someone wants to send me their tracks, I can do it for $250 a tune. And now, am I going to put a lot of work into it? No. In fact, I'll go down to $100 a tune. But I'm just going to throw some stuff in the height channels and be done with it, right? But anyway, so there's this big push now to do this, just because Apple's offering a higher royalty, and Apple wants to be special, and so therefore, you know, we're getting a lot of Atmos, and that's the only reason for it. Yeah, there are a few artists who are like, wow, let's do Atmos. I'd say the vast majority of artists, just as with surround sound back when we were doing 5.1, there were very few artists that cared. It's like, if the artists could make money on it, they're like, hey, great. But if it was going to be, if it was like going to be paid to the artist as an advance, and they were going to be recouping from the advance, the artist would say no. And apparently that's what happened with Led Zeppelin in surround, is that, you know, they said to Jimmy Page, well, you know, we'll, you're going to have to pay for it, basically. And he's, forget it. You know, how do I make money on that then? And he was right. And with Atmos, at least there is a way to make money. You're going to get more streaming revenues from Apple. And okay, so you can do a financial calculation, and you can say, well, we can calculate we're going to get this much extra revenue, and therefore it's worth us spending X amount of money on an Atmos mix. And he also points out that I think all of the top song nominees for the Grammys this year were available in an Atmos mix, and something like eight out of the 10 best album nominees or whatever they had were available in Atmos. So it's definitely catching on with the bigger artists. And I mean, it hasn't made a lot of inroads into, you know, other genres, but you know, if they can make money on it, which they can now, they will. Mm-hmm. And plus it's so easy to do. I mean, my next album, and hoping to finish by the end of the summer, I might just go ahead and do it in Atmos. And, you know, like I said, I can throw together Atmos mixes on a tune. I can do an Atmos mix in an hour. And, you know, will it be incredible? No. But it'll be Atmos. I'll just put some sounds. It's like, you know, it's like saxophone, guitar, drums and stuff, and I'll pan some drums into the back channels, and I'll put like a little reverb from the saxophone coming from up above you. And when you hear it through headphones, it'll just sound like a big spacey mess, but it doesn't matter. I don't care. It'll still be fine. And you know, if the one person who listens to it on his actual Atmos home theater system will be Dennis. Because he's going to have to actually tell me if the stuff works or not, because I'm not going to have my Atmos. So, I'll, I mean, I don't really. Out.
That'll like, be fun.
Okay, good. I'll send it to you two guys, and you can tell me if the mixes work.
I got reverb.
Yeah, you can tell me, but it's kind of like, yeah, so Atmos, it really is different from the surround sound thing, because of Apple, they can make money on it. And so they can do a financial calculation that says, okay, Apple's going to pay us this much more money. We're streaming, you know, we're making $1 million off of streaming, and Apple's going to double their royalty. So we're going to make $2 million. So if we spend, you know, $200,000 getting a bunch of stuff, getting all of our stuff redone in Atmos, hey, we're good to go. So, yeah, record company. That's what record companies understand.
It's pretty much every business, money.
Well, true. That's true. Yeah, but record companies don't do things for the rarely do things for artistic reasons. It's almost always money.
The company doesn't. The artist does. And the company is trying to get the artist to do it.
Right. Although my record company, well, it's not mine. It's the one I'm on. It's a little jazz label. They're going to be like, whatever.
You should tell them Blue Note's doing this, and they'd be like,
oh,
really? They'll be like, whatever. You know, there's, it's like, it's not a money making option. So, you know, like most of jazz is not much of a money making option. So it doesn't really matter. And the fact that I can do it, frankly, you can, you know, I'm doing it with free software. You don't even have to pay for the software. And, you know, it's like, gee, I can do this. I can install this on my computer. It takes me, it's a little extra time, but it's as much extra time as you want to put into it. It takes me, like I said, probably take me a minimum of an hour to do an Atmos mix on a tune. And that's probably also going to be my maximum.
Yeah.
Probably I did see,
you could do it for a podcast too. I did see that. And it's like, sure. I could do the podcast in Atmos, but it does take more time. And it's like, but just for kicks, I'm like, I'm a home theater pie. You know I'm doing it someday.
Oh, man.
I gotta do it, you know?
We should remix the intro to Audio Unleashed in Atmos, man.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Done.
But does that work, though? Does that work, then? Like, can you just have a part of, like, the show be in Atmos? And then what? Doesn't the whole show go to Atmos? You can't. No, I mean, it's not like it's going to go to 5.1 once you guys start talking, does it?
Well, since everything is in stereo. Right. So it's going to be, you know, Atmos, you know, folded down to stereo, which is, so for headphones, it'll be the same as if it was an Atmos encoded stream. Right. Right. We would have to upload a separate Atmos stream to do it to where it works over a home theater system.
Okay.
Right. So, or it works awesome. Over anything but headphones.
Hearing that could, unleashed,
Podbean doesn't really offer that, right?
No, they don't. They don't.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so Apple probably does, but Podbean does not, and so Podbean is our digital distributor on that. So, but I'll go ahead and do it in Atmos and remix it for Atmos, and so then we can. That's just good branding for us, and you know, a lot of other podcasts will probably be like, oh wow. Well, let's pay Brent to do this, and I'll be the next Stephen Wilson.
What nice. About this? Like, I know you say, because, like, your distributor probably doesn't do app. I know mine doesn't. The network that puts out the podcast, right? So it's already going out and it's not going to be Atmos. But, I mean, you guys do stuff on Patreon. I do stuff on Patreon. Can you upload your own Atmos track? Like, the version would be on Patreon. So if you wanted to, because you can upload that separately. It doesn't go out by your stream. Right. So you could actually do an Atmos track. Yeah. And that's, if you want to hear the Atmos track, go, you know, Patreon, and you can download or listen to us in Atmos on Patreon, because it would be, it's not distributed. It's literally uploaded to Patreon.
Maybe.
Is that possible?
If they're just storing a file, like, in other words, if I took an Atmos mix, and did a, you know, full on separate discrete Atmos mix as opposed to folded down stereo, I could upload it onto my Google Drive, and then you could play it. If you could find a way to get it out of your computer into your AV receiver, right, without
my somehow
crushing, and Dennis would have to tell you if that's how to do that.
I could do it.
Yeah, you just put it on a thumb drive and load it on your Roku, man.
Yeah.
Oh, you could do that. Whatever. Yep. So I will be consulting with Dennis on how to do this. But yeah. So
anybody with Plex, any of the media players, they could do it all day long.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So it is possible to do that. You know, whether or not, I mean, the only thing is, like, if I do it with our intro tune, it'll be kind of loud and spacey and Hendrixy anyway. So
yeah,
it'll just make it more spacey. and it'll be fine. And like I said, through headphones, it'll sound just like it would if you had an actual Atmos encoded track, right? It's just that it won't work on home theater systems, but I think probably the number of people that listen to our podcast on home theater systems is zero.
Zero, yeah.
It would grow infinitely if you put out an Atmos track, because that's what we would all do. We'd all just run to our theaters and be like, this one's in Atmos and listen to this. I'm just picturing your opening, the audio unleashed, and that unleashed actually moving away and like spreading out around the room. I think would, like, yeah, if you move that into that, all but, channels around you like a bubble, you'd be like, holy, yeah, that would be awesome.
Well, I'll try it. It'll be on the next one, because, like I said, it's not. I'm working on this other Atmos project, which I'm almost done with.
Well, the next one's in 38 minutes.
I get into there now anyway.
So. 8 minutes now.
8 minutes.
So, yeah, I gotta get into some Atmos messing around anyway, so I might as well pull up that thing. And, you know, it is, you have to put like the Atmos renderer on your, in a digital audio workstation, right? Every single track has to have an Atmos composer thing on it where you tell it where it's going to go. And then you have Atmos like render or whatever they call it that goes in your bus, in your two channel bus, right? Or your whatever bus. And that actually renders the Atmos for it. So, and yeah, it's got a little thing on there that's like a, you know, you've got like a head and like a bunch of speakers around it. And you can actually put in the easiest way is just to put in the azimuth and the, you know, you can put in the, oh, what do they call it? Dennis, help me. You know, you can put in the height and the XY cord. It's XYZ coordinates.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Axis.
Yeah. It was shockingly easy for me to do. Because I got this project, I'm kind of like, I got to be able to do this. And I think Dennis had said, oh, yeah, you can do that. And so I took his word for it. And I found the software to do it from Empirical Labs, I think it was. And it was free. And it works with Reaper, which is the digital audio workstation we use. And it was it worked. I mean, it does work. Cool. So,
you know, got a bunch of emails. We're both going to get a bunch of emails now. You should totally do that. You should totally do that. I want to hear that.
We'll do it. Next episode of the podcast, the opening music, which is, you know. That's exactly what it sounds like.
It is, pretty much, yeah. I guess I just need to render stems for all the voices for you then, because I've got like 9 tracks of voices in that intro, so.
Oh, that's right. Do I not? I don't have the original. You did the mix on that, right?
I did the mix on all of that, so I'll render those stems for you. Yeah.
Okay. Shoot me some tracks, man.
Brent's in my open. I have the same thing, and I just keep compressing it down. I did a while ago. I had listeners, anybody that was on, I'd say, you know, this is Brightside Home Theater. Remember that, Brent? And it's like, did it. And you're in it, but it's like, it's a giant mess. Imagine record. I'd have to go back and take everybody's voice, separate it out and have, I could do that. And like for all my listeners right now, it'd be like the end of Rise of Skywalker and you'd have like Brent in the back corner. You'd have this, you know, listeners here. It would be like, it'd be insane, but that's a lot of work. Cause I probably have like 20 people in there, you know, it's like it. Lot, you know, so, but that would be, that's a way to do it.
Honestly, the project I'm doing now has, oh, typically something like 16 or 18 tracks, and every one has its own Dolby Atmos composer in there, and every one of them has to, it's why it takes a while to,
right?
If you want to make a change, it takes a little while. But it's not, it just takes a little time. It's no big deal. Yeah. You can do it.
I know I can. I don't have the time. You get paid for this stuff, Brent. I'm just doing this for kicks.
I know. I don't get paid we don't get really paid to do our podcast. And I get paid to work for Wirecutter and an occasional freelance article, and that's it.
Oh, you're just having a fun project? You're just doing it for fun?
Oh, no. This other project, I'm doing it because I love the guy, but he's been a friend of mine for a long, long time, and I admire the work he does and everything. And he's going to give me a percentage on it, I guess. But I would have done it for nothing.
Don't tell him that.
Oh, no, he knows. He knows I'd do it for nothing because I did a project for him, like 20 years ago, and I didn't make anything on it. But I did it for other work reasons, yeah, you know, related reasons. But, you know, it's just fun. It's just a fun little project for me. And I just wanted to see if I can do it. And now I have more authority because, you know, if people want to call me a friggin' idiot when I talk about Atmos, I can say, well, hey, I've done here's my Atmos mix. Where's yours?
Yeah. There you go. Yep. And you got the beard. So there you go. Just to bring things right back around. So you got credibility. You got the beard. You've got experience. Look at you go.
Right.
We've got to teach Brandon how to stroke his beard. That's the thing. That's the skill that you haven't learned yet. You've got to stroke your beard when you're being thoughtful. That's a good start, man. But yeah, your beard stroking skills are a little lacking. Yeah.
The difference is when he gets thoughtful like that, like you were saying earlier, what was the term you used, Dennis? He's when he gets angry and he gets
going. The Credible Hulk.
The Credible Hulk. When he gets thoughtful and he gets all that Credible Hulk, you can't be stroking your beard when your like eyebrows are pushing down and it just doesn't work. Stroking your beard is thoughtful and like, you know, reflective, like, And he leans in and goes, they shouldn't, you know, and that's what we're looking for, right?
There was an audio publication decades ago, and the editor had like a photo of himself. He didn't have a beard, but he was like holding his chin in this really like self-important, like thoughtful kind of pose and looking at I'll do it so you guys can see, but it was kind of like,
yeah.
And I just felt like, what an idiot.
It's the three-quarter view, but the eyes are on the camera, right? That's like
what a pompous buffoon, which of course is probably kind of like the main qualifier to write for an audio publication. But I was just like, God, and I knew the dude, and he was kind of a lightweight. But anyway, I don't want to do that. I'd rather shave my beard off than do that. I would shave my beard off except for the fact that I test beard trimmers for Wirecutter.
I would shave my beard off except my wife has never seen my chin and I'd like to stay married.
That would be so funny. Like all of a sudden you really hear?
Yeah. I don't even know if she would recognize me without a beard.
If you said you've had it since high school. Yeah. I don't think you'd recognize you.
No, I don't spend a lot of time looking at me anyway, so maybe no. I don't know.
Yeah. But guys, thank you. This is, I say it every time, you know, Brent, you've been on it quite a few times and Dennis, your second time. And it's awesome having the two of you back. Can't wait to have you back in November. It's just so much fun. Love your show. Oh, by the way, that show was May 15th. What is it? One hillbilly shooting at another. It's the title of the show.
Oh, man. Brent got the title two episodes in a row. What a lot of people don't know is that when we come up with the title of the episode, it's during the editing process and we're listening and we'll just throw out, this is a funny line, this is a funny line. And usually I will sort of end up with a list and make Brent pick his favorite from the list, but that's how I end up with the show title. So, but the new episode, which is dropping exactly right now as we're recording, Brent kind of did a Babe Ruth, man. He called the title as we were recording. So,
was a fun one. He called his shot, huh?
He called his shot, man. Yeah.
I'm on iTunes right now. Let me see if it shows up. Nope. Still isn't there. One hillbilly shooting at another. That's an awesome title though. I mean, I was like, where is that going to pop up in the show?
Yeah.
in Audio Unleashed. What was the name? The past show you did, the Audiophile podcast, still has your pictures.
It does. Yeah, it does on iTunes. I've been trying to get Doug to update that because Jordan's got, you know, his own headshot on there. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's sometimes, you know, moving mountains, man. But
yeah, literally looks like you two right now. Like you get the same hat on, Dennis. It looks like, you know, But yeah, I keep going. I'm like, hey, wait a minute. But yeah. Yeah, go back and listen to their anniversary episode. Now, Brent, you might want to go back and listen to it. See why. But
never.
May 15th.
Never.
You don't listen to yourself back? Well, you don't have to after you've done editing and stuff. I don't either.
I listen to everything once as we're producing it, but once it's once we both approve it, I never listen to them again unless like somebody's in the car with me and they say, "Oh, play me your podcast," and I'll play them a minute up or something. Just the intro, and then by the time we get into the discussion of audio, they're like, "Oh, okay, that's fine."
Yep, I'm good.
That's fine. Cause people, I start talking about stuff, their eyes roll. Why would they want to listen to me talk about stuff?
Yeah.
You know,
I
actually when I was at Expona, I went to two of my listeners' houses. My son went with me to Expona. So I visited a couple home theaters out in the Chicago area, and we were leaving the first house, and they were so nice to me. The listeners, their families were nice to me. Everything was, it was awesome. And they were like, "We love your show. We listen to it at dinner, the live show, blah, blah, blah." We get in the car. I hadn't even like, I barely even touched the gas to pull out of the driveway. And my son's sitting there and he goes, "People listen to you on purpose." And I was like, "Well, yeah, but they have a choice. They can't shut it off." Oh, there goes Dennis again. And he's back.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on, guys. My internet must be wacky, but I'll tell you what, my phone is about to die. I've got like three pop-up messages, low battery mode, and I'm like,
there you go.
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you guys very much. Everybody, thank you for listening. You know what you gotta do.
Go push play. What he said.
Hey, Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.